I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. In this Q&A program, you'll meet Johnny Burtka, the executive director of the American Conservative. We talk about the history of the conservative movement and about a special edition of their magazine, which examines the movement's relevance in the age of Donald Trump. John Burtka, executive director and acting editor of the American Conservative. This summer, you've got a special issue of your organization's magazine asking the question, what is American conservatism? Tell me about this project.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Susan. I conceived of the project because there's a lot going on in our country right now, and it's unsettling times for a number of Americans. Everything having to do with the COVID crisis, to the lockdowns, to the killing of George Floyd and the subsequent protests and riots, and the presidential election. So a lot of people are taking the opportunity to really re-examine first principles and trying to figure out where we stand as a nation. And people on the right, as the end of the president's term comes into focus, are asking themselves, what is conservatism? Has the president made an impact on the overall trajectory of the conservative movement and of the Republican Party? And so I wanted to take this opportunity to re-examine those fundamental questions. And back in 1964, there was a seminal book that was dubbed The Federalist Papers of Conservatism by Jonah Goldberg, which examined the definition of conservatism. And it was put together by Frank Meyer, Bill Buckley, Russell Kirk, a lot of the conservative luminaries. And it came out in 1964, about 6 months before the presidential election, when Barry Goldwater was the Republican candidate. And it was designed to really be a book to pull together disparate strands on the right and hopefully bring them into one camp that would eventually coalesce into a vibrant political movement. It didn't succeed in 1964, but they did succeed at least at the ballot box with the election of Ronald Reagan. So I feel like we're in a time of transition on the right now, and we're figuring out where we're going to go. And it might not translate into an electoral victory in November. But really what we're doing is looking at the bigger picture and sort of examining the roots of where America should go as a country and what conservatism has to say about that.
If one searches top conservative magazines on the internet, there's a group called Thought Company, which ranked your publication number 3 and wrote this description. It's the magazine for the disenfranchised conservative, the one who is uncomfortable with the rash of false conservatives who have come to dominate the movement. Does that definition square with how you think of yourselves?
I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, we were founded in 2002 as a group of conservatives that were opposed to the war in Iraq, that wanted to advocate for realism and restraint in American foreign policy. And at the time, that went against the grain of Republicans in D.C., specifically those connected to the Bush administration. The founding purpose, though, was really even broader than foreign policy. It was to re-examine the questions that we believed had been ignored by elites in both parties since the end of the Cold War. There's sort of a confidence, maybe a hubris, in the end of history after the Cold War. And so we wanted to re-examine questions not only relating to foreign policy, but also relating to the economic structures in our country. We wanted to, you know, essentially advocate for a conservatism in an America that promotes a healthy middle class and strong and vibrant local communities and families. So we've continued to do that. And I would say that with the election of Donald Trump in 2016, we've been able to shift from being a gadfly, sort of off on the side, who's sort of critical of where things are, to being more of a major player in terms of participating in the national conversations. Because with the election of Donald Trump, interestingly enough, at least in the conservative intellectual world, reopened a host of new questions, particularly on foreign policy, political economy, that has allowed us a real opportunity to shape the future of the right.
How are you organized and funded?
We're funded by donor-supported predominantly, so 92% of our revenue comes from donors. We have a $2.5 million budget. We produce the print magazine 6 times a year. We have about 30 stories a week on the website. And then we also do a number of educational programs. We have about 10 conferences and panel events a year across the country on different issues that we focus on in the magazine. And then we also have a constitutional fellows program that we host for young and mid-career professionals on the Hill.
And who are some of the people that our viewers would recognize who are associated with the American Conservative?
That's a great question. So in terms of our advisory board, we have Fox News host Tucker Carlson is on our advisory board. We have Yuval Levin, who's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. We have David Azarad of Hillsdale College. And we've got sort of a nice mix. We have our founders, Pat Buchanan, Scott McConnell, and a number of other voices that we've pulled on along the way.
In your essay in contributing to this seminar, you go through a brief history of the modern conservative, American conservative movement. And I want to do some of that with you as well during our hour together. I also want to talk to you a little bit about your own personal journey to conservatism. But you wrote, and it caught my attention, before we can understand the nature of American conservatism and its relevance for today, we must first define what we mean by America and what we mean by conservatism. Okay, so I'll bite. Let's start with conservatism. What is it?
Yeah, so to me, conservatism is an active thing. It's a practice more than it is an idea. And from my perspective, conservatism is the practice of conservation and cultivation. So then the question is, what, of course, are we conserving? And as Americans, I think that it's conserving the great traditions throughout our country's history. And that goes back to the founders. And even before that, to the first settlers that came to this country. But it also goes back to the great statesmen. I think there's been a tendency within conservatism to say that conservatism or America is only an idea, and it's an idea that we can replicate and export all over the world. And unfortunately, we've attempted to do that through our foreign policy quite often, and it's gone awry. So I think conservatism is more than just an idea. It's really the stories and the people that have taken part in the wonderful history that we have here in America. And it also stretches back to the Judeo-Christian foundations of Western thought and Greco-Roman traditions going all the way back to from Aristotle to Thomas Aquinas, all the way throughout the medieval tradition and culminating in America.
And how do you define America?
How do I define America? Well, I think it's important to understand that America, as I said, it's not only an idea, it's also a place. And it's a place that we call home, and it's a place that we love. And there are, it's a place, and it's an experiment in ordered liberty and virtue. And we've had successes and failures throughout our history. We've seen the scope of government grow and contract for small periods of time. And I think the important thing when we're looking at America from a conservative perspective is the goal is to really take the best of our traditions and apply them to the future. So it's not only a backwards-looking exercise, it's really a forward-looking exercise, trying to cultivate the ideas from the past and implement them now in order to have a more a just, equitable, virtuous, and free society.
Well, on that note, you also wrote that the first task of conservatives is to take stock of the country as it is, not as they imagine it to be. What are you saying there?
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at there is much of the conservative movement has had the goal of dismantling the New Deal programs that were started under FDR. Because they inevitably led to what conservatives like to call the administrative state or the fourth branch of government that's unelected and unaccountable to the people in a direct sense. And I think there are very much legitimate criticisms to make of the New Deal and criticisms to make of the administrative state. But I think the challenge is that our country has, that this sort of our system of government as it is today has really been in place and evolved, over the last 100 years. So I really don't think that the administrative state is going anywhere. despite conservatives' best efforts. And I also think that the task of sort of pushing power back to the states is a daunting one. And I think it's something that we should continue working on, but I don't think that's the full task of conservatism. So I think conservatives also need to look at where it's appropriate to use the structures that as it exists today to serve conservative ends. So a couple areas that I'd like to focus on are strengthening the American family, finding ways to support working mothers and fathers, whether that's through things like paid family leave policies or other policies to promote family formation. I think trade policy and economic policy are two other areas. I think the costs of globalization over the last 30 years certainly has come with some benefits, but I think the cost has been stagnant middle-class wages and downward mobility for a lot of Americans, which leads to civil unrest and populist discontent on the right and left. So I think that's especially important to re-examine vis-a-vis China and their growing influence in the world today. And I also think we have to take a look at the tech monopolies and the concentrated power that we have on Wall Street today. And traditionally speaking, conservatives have liked to cut taxes, which again, I understand there's lots of probably red tape that shouldn't be there. But generally speaking, conservatives don't really get, at least traditional conservatives, don't really get a lot in return. You know, one of the signature achievements of the Trump presidency was the corporate tax cut. But it's really the corporations that are leading the charge in terms of a social agenda that is very much at odds with a traditionalist conservative perspective. So I would say the bargain that conservatives have struck with Wall Street and with the libertarian influence on the right hasn't always translated into protecting and preserving faith, family, and local communities. So I think it's time that there's some reexamination done on the right. And I think, limited government and just pushing back against all things government is there's something to it, but I think it's an incomplete picture. So I think we need to take stock of all the influences that are currently exerting themselves on our country and really formulate a strategy that can strengthen the things we hold dear. And again, I think that's a strong middle class, vibrant families, and a path to upward mobility for all Americans.
Well, as you listen to your list of important topics, it sounds like there's some real common ground with progressives.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah,
do you differ on the prescription?
Yeah, I think when we're, looking at the overlap between progressives and conservatives, particularly on sort of the populist right today, there's a bit of an overlap. And I think the progressives are very good at identifying problems that are really hurting the country. I think Bernie Sanders was great at identifying very real problems that are holding America back and keeping Americans down. I think it's more a difference in terms of the solutions to those problems. I'm certainly open to dialogue with progressives on what the problems are. And that's something that we've done quite a bit, particularly on foreign policy throughout our magazine's history.
When you were describing what conservatism means to you, you talked about the need to or a desire to conserve the ideals of the founders. And I'm wondering what you think about the energy within the Black Lives Matter movement to re-examine our founding fathers and their role in the system that they set up of government.
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly a timely one with everything going on in the country. Where I'm coming from is I think that it's important that we take an honest look at American history. And there seems to be two tendencies right now. There's a tendency on the left to say that American history needs to be erased. You know, looking at the 1619 Project, sort of the animating idea, or at least one of them, is that the American Revolution was fought to preserve slavery, essentially. And so the tendency on the left is to cancel America and to sort of erase or break from the past and to start over again. And there's a tendency on the right to basically say, America is perfect. The founding was ordained by God, divinely inspired. Our country's never done anything wrong. It's a great place. I don't know what you're complaining about. So I think the answer, I think it lies somewhere in between. I think we have a history and tradition that can be that we can be proud of. I think if you go back and examine the principles that animated the American founding, principles in the Declaration of Independence, the idea of equal justice and liberty under the law, the inherent dignity of each human person, I think there's a lot in our American tradition that people who care about justice would do well to study and learn from and sort of bring that to bear in creating a more just society today. So I think the conservative disposition, as I mentioned, you know, it's about conservation and cultivation. So I think there's a quote that says, you know, the individual is foolish, but the species is wise. And I think that's a very important lesson, that even from our vantage point today, it's easy to look back and see everything that the founders did wrong, but it's harder to see where our own blinders might be today. So I think the general posture that we ought to have towards history is one of deference. However, it's the cultivation aspect of conservatism where we take those best traditions from the past and cultivate them and steward them for today. And that doesn't preclude a reexamination of the historic legacy of slavery and its impact on America today. But I think it's about an approach to history. And I think there's a stark difference there between conservatives and progressives right now.
When you look at the list of contributors to your symposium on the state of American conservatism, there's only two women's names. And I'm wondering, as a jumping off point for that, the question about the people of various demographics who participate in the conservative movement. Is it inclusive enough for your satisfaction?
I think it could certainly be more inclusive. When I was reaching out to people to write for the symposium, I initially sort of, you know, gravitated towards those who are the editors of magazines and publications on the right today, or those who led think tanks or institutions. And most of them on the right tend to be, as you mentioned, tend to be males, and they tend to be older. I think it's in terms of a successful long-term project, I think conservatism would do well to cultivate more voices from more diverse backgrounds. I think that's definitely something to work on.
How does that happen?
That's a really good question. I think it comes down to, ultimately, it comes down to relationships. I think it's less a result of an intentional effort to exclude women or blacks, you know, Hispanics in the conservative movement. I think it really comes down to relationships, and people tend to congregate with people that think like they do, act like they do, and travel in similar social circles as they do. So I think it really probably sprung up more organically in that respect. So I think, you know, the best place to start is by being intentional about cultivating relationships with people that might not be in the current sort of group of conservative intellectual thinkers, and sort of bringing them on board that way.
As you did in the magazine, I mentioned, go through a very brief history of some of the stages of American conservatism in the United States during the 20th century. It had its roots in the mid-20th century. Tell me how it got started.
So conservatism really, as a intellectual and political movement, really began as a pushback against collectivism and against the New Deal, seeing it as a violating constitutional principles and sort of an overgrowth of government. And then it began to morph with the challenge that we had against communism overseas, and seeing the influence of communist thought, particularly on American intellectuals and American publications. So it really started off as this sort of a quirky intellectual movement with a few, you know, political figures pushing back against collectivism at home and abroad. And really some of the seminal moments were the publication of Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind, which famously did not try to sort of pigeonhole a narrow or an ideological definition of conservatism, but took examples of conservative statesmen throughout history and basically painted more of a conservative disposition than an ideology. And then you, of course, had the founding of National Review magazine back in 1955 by William F. Buckley Jr., which really began to sort of bring these diverse camps into play. And it wasn't only those pushing back against big government or the Soviet Union. You also had traditional and religious conservatives that tended to have not only a social conservatism, but also many of them were Catholic. So they had sort of a sense of piety for, you know, the great saints and teachers throughout church history. So you had the economic conservatives in one camp, you had the social and traditional conservatives in another camp, and then you had the foreign policy hawks that were concerned about the Soviet Union in another camp, and then you also had disaffected people from the left who were concerned particularly about the Soviet Union and the Cold War, who are now called neoconservatives, people like Irving Kristol and Commentary magazine when that was founded, fusing into the conservative movement that really coalesced around the Reagan presidency.
You mentioned some of the founding lights of American conservatism. I want to show people two of them that you just mentioned so we can see and hear some of these people and hear their thinking. Let's begin with a clip from Russell Kirk later on in his life, June 4th, 1980. This is from the C-SPAN archives. Let's watch.
American intellectual renewal of conservative ideas, beginning around 1950, was perfectly unorganized and undirected, the work of isolated individual scholars and men of letters, only slightly acquainted with one another's work, let alone enjoying personal acquaintance. Take the names of men whose books obtained some attention, perhaps as novelties, shortly before or after 1950. Richard Weaver, Daniel Boorstin, Peter Virick, Francis Wilson, William Buckley. When I published my book, The Conservative Mind, in 1953, I had never met any of these gentlemen except Weaver, nor had they met one another, with but few exceptions, I believe. Besides, no two of them agreed perfectly about anything, not even about the word conservative.
Talking about how this movement really got its starts, but how important was his book, The Conservative Mind, to the genesis of the movement?
Incredibly important. Most people attribute it to being the founding of the conservative intellectual movement in America. As he mentioned, at the time, there really were quite disparate voices, and many of the people didn't even know each other. So I think this was the first systematic attempt to bring together a diverse array of thinkers, historic figures, and talking about sort of what, as a body of work, conservatism is, and hopefully trying to apply it to what it might mean or might become in America.
What was the relationship between the conservative intellectuals and the president, presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, both President Eisenhower and Richard Nixon?
The relationship between Eisenhower and the conservatives was tenuous. I believe there's an Eisenhower quotation that I can paraphrase, where he essentially thought that people on the right who are trying to dismantle or do away with things like Social Security or other government programs, he thought that they were utopian in their outlook, mostly because he said these are programs that your ordinary Americans, middle class Americans, working class Americans, they like them. They provide an extra degree of security and support. They have been embraced in the American consciousness, and it would be political suicide for any politician, no matter what the party, Republican or Democrat, to try to remove or dismantle those programs. So I think while Eisenhower would certainly probably, you know, agree with certain conservative dispositions, I think the political attempt to undo various welfare programs, he was highly skeptical of. In terms of Richard Nixon, there's a Buchanan, Pat Buchanan, who had worked in the Nixon administration, was asked by, I believe it was by Bill Buckley, but it was someone at National Review, you know, are you the conservative movement's representative to the Nixon administration? Are you the Nixon administration's representative to the conservative movement? And he said he was the latter. So I think the relationship between those two presidents and the formalized conservative movement was a bit tenuous.
How important was Senator Robert Taft to the conservative movement in the 1950s?
He was very, very important. He was, you know, held up as a model and an ideal statesman, you know, pushing back against, you know, a more aggressive approach to American foreign policy. He was a staunch defender of, you know, individual liberties, constitutional government. So I think to many people in the conservative movement, and certainly to many people at the American Conservative, he's a model that we've held in high esteem.
You mentioned William F. Buckley. We have a clip from him from 2002. Let's listen and we'll talk about his legacy in the conservative movement.
Fundamentally, a liberal is less anchored than the conservative in what we like to think of as central and fixed ideas having to do with liberty and with order, with transcendence. The liberal fancies himself a more empirical, less tied down to any orthodoxy, and very hospitable to the idea of the state being used as an instrument by which to make human progress.
Well, first of all, on his point, liberals are less anchored than conservatives. Do you agree?
I do not agree with that sentiment. In one sense, I don't agree because at least liberals today, maybe at the time, I think the statement would be true. But today, I think so much depends of, you know, a neutral public square where diverse voices can engage in free speech and open debate. I think there's very much a positive ideological component driving liberalism today in America. And I think there's whether it comes to sexual ethics or whether it comes to a view of America's history and America's founding, I don't think it's liberal in the classical sense anymore. I think there actually is a sort of an anchored positive ideology. It's one that I disagree with, and I think it's one that is counter to a conservatism that really anchors itself in history and tradition. But I certainly think that there is an anchor behind how the left sees the world today.
And what is William F. Buckley's legacy to the movement?
Well, I mean, his legacy is that he ran and founded, you know, the most influential conservative publication of the 20th century that exerted a great deal of influence on Republican politics. So in that sense, I think it's a positive legacy. But at the same time, I think there are some pitfalls. I think he overemphasized the importance of politics and electoral victories at the expense of other cultural concerns. I think the magazine National Review, towards the end of his life, I know that Buckley came to regret supporting the war in Iraq, but you know, he and his magazine, in some sense, led the charge of leading the United States or encouraging the United States to pursue regime change in Iraq. They may not have been as unified in their support of the Iraq war as Bill Kristol in the Weekly Standard, but I think they were certainly complicit in that, and also complicit in sidelining dissenting conservative voices throughout throughout the history of the conservative movement. And I think if they were slightly less ideological and had been more open, both intellectually and also in terms of dissenting voices, Buckley's legacy would be more positive today. I think you could see, in some sense, the election of Donald Trump as a repudiation of the fusionist synthesis that Buckley championed at National Review. You see today on the right, you know, a shift away from free trade in terms of, especially vis-a-vis China, supporting more of an economic nationalism or economic patriotism. You see a greater skepticism of foreign interventionism, and you see more concern not only about big government, but also about big business. And those in many respects run counter to Buckley's legacy at National Review. Now, at the same time, I think he was also a brilliant intellectual and a scholar and a writer. So if he were around today, I also think he would adapt to the times and to the new challenges. And I hope he would be less perhaps ideologically rigid than some people would like to think.
You mentioned his emphasis on the ballot box. The conservative movement got its first run at the White House in 1964 with the campaign of Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona. We have the clip, a well-known clip from his acceptance speech in 1964. Let's listen and we'll come back to you.
Let our republicanism, so focused and so dedicated, not be made fuzzy and futile by unthinking and stupid labels. I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
People saw Richard Nixon listening in as he gave that acceptance speech. What does that quote mean to you today?
Yeah, well, that's it. Certainly is a powerful quote. I think there are some flaws with it, though. I think the mindset, I think, well, first, I think the flaw from a conservative perspective is that prudence is really the pinnacle of virtues when it comes to conservatism. And so extremism, you know, in pursuit of liberty is a bit of an oxymoron. I think it's important to have strong convictions, to have a clear sense of where you want to go as a culture and a society. But I think ultimately extremism, as he describes it, needs to be tempered with prudence and also, you know, what's actually politically possible. And obviously, in terms of the winning the election, that message didn't quite work for him. Now, at the same time, it did spur a intellectual and political movement that was later taken up by Ronald Reagan, who I think was a far more effective messenger in terms of packaging the ideas of liberty that certainly Goldwater held dear. But he made them not sound extreme, but he made them sound palatable and even attractive to ordinary middle-class Americans. So I think that was Reagan's virtue. So that's where I would take that quote.
Well, let's listen to Ronald Reagan and his inauguration address, first inauguration address in January 20th, 1981, and hear how he described his goals.
Our government has no power except that granted it by the people. It is time to check and reverse the growth of government, which shows signs of having grown beyond the consent of the governed. It is my intention to curb the size and influence of the federal establishment and to demand recognition of the distinction between the powers granted to the federal government and those reserved to the states or to the people.
Yeah. Johnny Burtka, how did Ronald Reagan govern versus his ideals that brought him to office?
Well, I think he found out that it's a lot harder to scale back the federal bureaucracy in Washington than he may have thought. I don't think he was naive about the monumental challenge that he was up against, and he certainly, you know, cut taxes and used deregulation and other things to free and unleash the economy in a way that I think was quite successful. But I think in terms of taking a look at the federal government, the bureaucratic apparatus, and really making meaningful reforms, I think he came up a bit thin. And I think that's because the administrative state has a life of its own, and it has entrenched bureaucratic interests, and Congress is not as they're content passing off a lot of their legislative responsibilities to the administrative state. And I think even someone as great as Ronald Reagan ultimately wasn't, he was successful in terms of the modest, well, certainly in foreign policy with communism and the end of the Cold War, he was successful. But in terms of really reining in the power of the federal government, I think he certainly helped to delay expanding growth, but he wasn't able to stop it, let alone cause it to go into retreat.
It became known as the Reagan Revolution, but you write, in the decades after the Reagan administration, American conservatism became unmoored from its intellectual forebears. What are you seeing there?
Well, I think it lost the glue that held it together. So you had, as I mentioned before, the different coalitions, the foreign policy hawks, the social conservatives, and then the economic libertarians. And I think political coalitions form primarily on account of external threats. So you have people banding together who find themselves more like each other than the people that are opposing them. So they come together, they work on a joint project, and they succeeded. But after that success happened, I think they lost the villain that really kept them all in the same camp together. So I think you saw after that a search essentially for a new boogeyman to hold the conservative coalition together, which I think was a mistake, because I think it's perfectly fine for disparate groups to come together to achieve a specific purpose, and then after that purpose is achieved, for them to go their separate ways and maybe form new coalitions with new groups. But you saw, after 9/11 and the war on terror and the war in Iraq, I think there was an attempt to make Islamic terrorism the new Soviet Union, the new glue that could hold together the disparate conservative coalition. And I think that ended up being a failure, not because something needed to be done about 9/11, but I think the response was to look for a new monster that could really unite people together, and it turned out not working out so well. That didn't work out well for the over 500,000 Iraqis that ended up losing their life, and it didn't work out for the population of Christians in Iraq. There's actually around 1.3 million Christians in Iraq prior to the war. And now there's only about 300,000 left. Many of them were displaced or moved, and some of them were certainly killed. So I think this is a case where there's a zeal to find something to hold the coalition together, a zeal to find an enemy that's threatening America, but it really lacked humility and also the prudence, exercise of prudence, because when you take a look at the world, this is what I had mentioned before about seeing the world as it is. Oftentimes, you may have a situation where you have a dictator like Saddam Hussein and people really suffering beneath that dictator, but overthrowing the dictator ends up leading to anarchy, which ends up being far worse for the people than they were originally. So I think that's where the principles of humility and prudence really come into play. So I think looking forward now, it's interesting seeing, can there be anything that holds this conservative coalition together? And is that really the right way to be thinking about things on the right?
So before we bring this conversation into today, I wanted to learn a little bit more about yourself. You talked earlier about the need to bring more young people into the movement. How did you get involved? When did you first decide you were a conservative?
Yeah, for me, it really began with my family upbringing. My father worked in the auto industry in Detroit. And when the auto industry ended up going south, he took our life savings and poured it into a small business. He actually had the courage to start a small winery in Michigan, which is a thing. There's actually over 100 wineries in the state of Michigan right now. So I sort of began to learn the conservative principles, really instilled through my family, through entrepreneurship and localism, involvement, engagement in the local community and our local church, and worked there pretty much every weekend from when I was 12 years old behind the counter all the way through college. And then when I went to college, ended up going to Hillsdale College, which is pretty well known as one of the more conservative universities in the country. Funny enough, when I first arrived at Hillsdale, I knew very little about the conservative intellectual tradition or really even about the Western heritage. And it was at Hillsdale that I had the opportunity, really for the first time, to do a deep study of the great books, going all the way back to Aristotle and all the way up to the founders and contemporary American history. So Hillsdale was really the transformational experience in terms of intellectual conservatism. From there, I ended up studying theology in France for a year in Provence, was able to practice my French skills a bit, and then came back to the United States on the East Coast and decided that I wanted to get back plugged into the conservative intellectual movement. And Dr. Arne, the president of Hillsdale, helped me to get my first job at ISI, which, interestingly enough, ISI was an organization also founded by William F. Buckley Jr., dedicated to promoting the conservative intellectual tradition on college campuses throughout the country. And it was when I was at ISI doing fundraising, helping to find donors that would support conservative journalists, that's where I discovered the American Conservative, because I was reading nearly every conservative publication and raising funds to place student journalists and recent graduates at those publications, that the American Conservative really jumped out to me as one conservative publication that was unafraid and willing to sort of buck the trends of the Republican Party and see things through fresh eyes. So that's what drew me to the American Conservative. And I started out overseeing the development side of things. And then my role has grown and expanded, so that now I'm overseeing the whole thing as executive director and acting editor.
We have in our video library the president of Hillsdale, Larry Arne, from September of 2016, talking about its course of study. I'd like to show that to our audience so they can learn a little bit more about the education you received there.
The subject matter of the college is the ultimate things, the ends of life, the things for which we live our lives. And those are things that are identified in the classical and medieval and Renaissance literature, and some modern literature, as being the things that are good simply for their own sake, and there's nothing you could add to them that would make them better. I teach Aristotle's Ethics here, and love to teach that as much as anything I teach. And the kids love it. All the kids read the first book of the Nicomachean Ethics before they come here for their freshman year.
And required.
We send them a book. Uh-huh. And read this, you know. And then the rest of the 4 years is to come to understand what that and things like that mean, including in the natural sciences, which are very strong here.
American higher education has tended in the last couple of decades towards a practical skill building rather than foundational learning. When you left college, how did you feel that this kind of education supported you for the life you wanted to lead?
Thanks. That's a great question. Well, I mean, I felt like my education at Hillsdale really gave me a comprehensive, but not exhaustive, a comprehensive understanding of the human person, the dignity of the human person, and also our place within the greater context of American history and Western history. So I left college not with a particular skill set in terms of job skills, but with a greater perspective to understand, you know, what the human person is, what is the good, what is the purpose of human life and life together in society. And one lesson that I drew, especially from Dr. Arndt's Aristotle class, which he mentions, is the idea that where there is justice, friendship is still needed. But where there is friendship, justice is not needed, because friendship, people who are friends with each other end up treating each other justly. And I think that's one of the great challenges that our country is going through now. There's an understandable push for justice. But I think, you know, given the atomization and the sort of the isolation that has been part of American society for the last 10 or 20 years, thanks in large part to technology, but which is now exacerbated by the virus and the subsequent shutdowns, I think it's important to remember that it's really friendship that holds cities together and holds countries together. And if we had a greater emphasis on that, we would do better as a people. So I really left Hillsdale feeling like I was equipped to do anything and learn anything and take on any challenge that might come my way. And thanks to mentors and people like Dr. Arndt, people have been willing to give me an opportunity to do that. And I've been able to grow in my career and my personal and professional life because of it.
Well, let's spend our last 15 minutes with thoughts about today. What do you see the 2016 election of Donald Trump as being all about?
I think it's about four things, really. I think first and foremost, it was about the failures of American foreign policy and American empire for the past 30 years. President Trump on the stage in South Carolina on the debate stage is probably the first Republican candidate to ever sort of publicly denounce the war in Iraq, maybe with the exception of Ron Paul, but that wasn't really taken that seriously. He was written off by Rudy Giuliani. But so I think challenging the overreach of American foreign policy, I think trade policy, specifically globalization and China, and the impact of losing, you know, 100,000 approximate factories since China joined the World Trade Organization in 2000, which ended up in many ways exacerbating things like the opioid epidemic and sort of the sense of frustration and despair felt in many of the communities that once relied on those manufacturing jobs. I think it was about immigration, particularly the impact that mass immigration had on driving down working class wages and the frustration over that. And then I also think it was about political correctness and a fatigue that ordinary Americans felt being lectured at by corporate America and by Hollywood. And I think Donald Trump, despite the fact that he was often quite crude in his denunciations of political correctness, I think he hit a nerve in terms of challenging it, that. So I would say it's that constellation of those four issues that really led to his victory in 2016.
Let's listen to Donald Trump in his inaugural address.
We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Is America first consistent with conservative thinking?
I think it depends how you define it, but I certainly think it can be consistent. And I think it's a healthy alternative to George W. Bush's, you know, second inaugural address, which had very much a sort of a utopian vision of American military might bringing democracy throughout the world, particularly in the Middle East. So I think if America first means that, you know, we still engage and have allies and friendly relationships with other countries, but we reprioritize our foreign policy decisions, our economic and trade decisions, decisions about immigration, decisions about taking care of those who are suffering and those who are hurting in our own country over the interests of global capital and over the interest of the military-industrial complex, then I think America First, rightly understood, is very much consistent with conservative principles.
You mentioned how important it was for friendship, which preceded justice for all. Donald Trump's Twitter feed and many of his speeches are very tough on his adversaries. How has that, do you think, worked to advance the principles of the conservative movement?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think to me, the lesson to draw from Donald Trump is that the policy, well, it's threefold, I guess. The policies, I think there's a debate sort of going on whether Donald Trump won because he was brash and his style of, you know, reality TV star and just sort of pulverizing his enemies. Is that what got him elected, or was it actually the substantial issues that his campaign raised? And I fall in the second camp, thinking it was really those four issues that I mentioned. And I think that would be the key to his victory moving forward. I think one of the lesson, though, to draw from his style is that there is a large group of Americans who feel like they've been left behind. The president talked about American carnage in his inaugural address. And I think a lot of people just want to go on thinking everything's great in the country and haven't paid attention to that silent majority of people. And I think those people are looking for someone who fights for them. So to the extent that Trump is combative, I think there is something that resonates about his willingness to fight. But I would say that his style has become problematic, where he relentlessly attacks people and it oftentimes doesn't produce any political gain or any concrete victories for those people that supported him in 2016. So I think it's one of those things where I understand the importance of fighting for middle America. At the same time, I think you need to pick and choose your battles, and you also have to show charity, because that's a conservative principle, and that's also a Christian principle. So I think it would be foolish for conservatives to jettison that.
We have about 5 minutes left. As we look back over the 70 years or so of American conservative movement in this country, we went to two charts which show the growth of government, both by the size of federal expenditures, and then also the growth of federal debt. Now, the problem with this is that it's just hard numbers. It doesn't say as a percentage of GDP, which I know is an important thing to do. But you can see that in both charts that the numbers keep rising as the decades go along. So I guess the question is, if the size of government has been an organizing principle of conservative movement, how effective has it been over the past 70 years?
Not very effective. Unfortunately, it's something that seems to have a life of its own, and it continues to grow. And it seems like you can only slow the expansion of debt and the growth of the federal government. You can't ever really reverse it. So I think this is something that conservatives really need to have a serious look at. I think slowing the debt and coming up with strategies to mitigate it is worthwhile. But I think conservatism needs to be more than on one side growing the GDP and on the other side reducing the federal debt, right? Conservatism has to do with the human person. It has to do with culture, friendship, and local traditions. And there are a great many local traditions throughout America that are worth conserving and protecting. And it's about the family, too. And so I think sure, those things can be part of the conservative project, but if they're the only reason for the project, then I think conservatism is a failure and deserves to be one.
Well, in this exercise that you're going through to re-examine American conservatism, you write that throughout American history, Americans have turned to the federal government during times of crises. Can American conservatism survive coronavirus where people are looking to the federal government and state governments for solution. They're looking to Big Pharma to supply vaccines and medications, and we're looking towards more international cooperation to share results of study.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't have American conservatism without America. So there are certain situations, right, where there is a crisis, that is so large that the federal government or the state governments need to take action. And in taking action, they're actually able to preserve the country and the people who live there. So I wouldn't be dogmatic about the need to use political power in cases of emergency. However, I am also skeptical of whether or not that political power and the money that's expended actually goes, you know, to support working and middle class Americans and families. I think there's a tendency for bailouts to go to the large corporations, and, you know, in the form of cronyism and people who have the power to lobby for the funds. So I would say, in theory, I support using political power to address national crises. But in practice, I'm skeptical of how it plays out. So I think we need to be careful to rush to use political power if there are other options on the table.
The impetus for our conversation was the summer issue of the American Conservative magazine, which you are now editing for your organization, and the seminar on what is American conservatism. You've kindly made a link available for C-SPAN viewers who want to see more of what you've done in this magazine. What will they find on that link? Who's there?
So when they go to that link, they'll find 22,000 word essay responses to the question of what is American conservatism. We've got the overall sort of tone and consensus is really sort of tapping into some of the new things that I'm talking about going on in conservatism. But we have a diverse array of voices, from people that are conservative nationalists to people that are conservative localists, to others who think that conservatism and the conservative project is a failure, to others who believe that conservatism is really about a more Christian, humanistic vision of learning to love thy neighbor and practice charity. So we've got a great spectrum, and I think it'll be really helpful for people looking to understand, you know, just what the heck is going on in conservatism since the election of Donald Trump, and what can we expect from the conservative movement in the post-Trump years to come.
And what do you hope will happen as a result of this exercise?
Well, I hope that we can bring, you know, more conservatives and more Americans generally of both political parties to support a policy agenda and a cultural agenda that strengthens the American middle class, that strengthens the American family, that restrains our utopian foreign policy, and that promotes a trade and economic policy that really can support Americans. So that's my goal.
Mr. Burtka, thank you very much for spending an hour with C-SPAN.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email at podcasts@c-span.org with your questions, comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.